Primary egress is always going to be your main door leaving leaving the house. The secondary means of egress, all residents must have two means of egress. If you have a loft, you'll have to have a secondary means of egress in the sleeping area. The minimum size is going to be an opening of 17 by 24.
Hi, this is Leanne. Welcome to the first NOAA podcast. We heard you, and by popular demand, we are making the change from a monthly written newsletter to a podcast. In this podcast, our inspectors will address trailers, stairs and guardrails, egress, and electrical. So let's get started.
Well, okay, I'm going to go ahead and start with the introductions. As people are coming on board here, they're not going to miss too much, but I do want to honor everyone else that's out there that we do like to get started on time here. So my name is Robin Butler. I'm with NOAA, and we have on tonight with us three of our inspectors. There's Andy from Virginia, Rich from Pennsylvania, and Tony is in Georgia. These are all certified professional inspectors. Tony's a certified professional inspector with InterNACHI, and Andy and Rich both have International Code Council certifications. We're going to be spending a little bit of time today talking about some of the things that they've seen along the way as they've been doing these inspections. So guys, say hi to everyone.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
All right. I think we'll probably start with the foundation on the trailer, and we'll just do it like, you know, anybody that any of three of you want to talk about some of these items, let's go ahead and get started with the trailer. And anybody, let's talk about the secondhand or the RV trailer. I've seen where they take the an RV and they take the top of that off. They have an old RV that somebody gave them and they want to build a tiny house. You want to speak to that?
I would say that's one of the hardest to do. Because all the components on an RV are already lightweight. So to try and transform that into a tiny house is challenging, to say the least, because you have to be concerned with the weight.
What about a utility trailer, like a car hauler or equipment hauler? It's heavy enough to carry it.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be ideal.
Okay. So you could do a secondhand trailer that was used for hauling equipment or cars that was heavy enough to handle the weight of a tiny house. And we have some, on our website, we have some weight estimations. For instance, a 20 footer is about 10,000 pounds. And so if you have a 20 foot RV trailer that has two 3,500 pound axles underneath them, obviously they're not gonna support the weight of 10,000 pounds, along with the frame and all that. But a utility trailer would have the ability to carry that, maybe with two 5,200 or two 7,500 pound axles. But then the weight distribution on a utility trailer or a car hauler is putting the weight in the middle, where on you have to be careful if you use a utility trailer to how are you going to support the weight on the perimeter. And if you're going to go wider than, for instance, the one in that picture is inside of the tires, which for me is probably about 6 feet wide, and you may want to make it a foot wider on either side, so may have some difficulty doing that. But would you say the best solution is to build or buy a trailer that's designed specifically for carrying a tiny house? Is that a
Absolutely.
Well, what if somebody wants to build it themselves? They're not going to go to a trailer company.
They do have that option, but there's standards within our information packets, as well as I believe NFPA and
ANSI.
ANSI
9.5. Yeah.
Right. Yes.
So there's standards in there that they can absolutely go off of and build their own trailer if they have the means.
Or could they get an engineer to draw up the trailer and they could build it themselves?
Definitely an option. Absolutely.
Okay. Andy, can you talk about the attachment of the homes to the trailer? I think you have a story to tell us.
Yeah, I encountered it over the weekend. The attachment points are essential of making sure it stays on there. I was traveling to Kentucky over the weekend and crossing through the bridge heading into Ohio. Somebody was towing a tiny house that they had built. It wasn't attached properly, and they happened to clip one of the struts on the bridge, and the tiny house left the trailer. Now, he built it pretty strong because it didn't fall apart in the street, but it was no longer connected to his trailer. So it's essential to bolt them in where you need to make sure they stay in place.
Okay, and we have that on our website. If when you become a member, we have that in the member portal where how you can attach the trailer to the tiny house or the tiny house to the trailer and all the strapping and all of that. What about a title or a VIN number? I know there's some places like California where you can't get a VIN until after it's built. What do we do in the cases where we don't have a VIN number?
Well, in those cases, we make them put some type of temporary identification on there. It wouldn't actually be a VIN number, but a means of us being able to identify that particular trailer every time we do an inspection.
Okay. And then a lot of times what they'll do is they'll get a letter of origin for a trailer, a utility trailer, and then they build a tiny house on it. Have you ever seen anyone changing that into a travel trailer title, or do they leave it as a utility trailer?
I don't know how that would work with the different municipalities, yeah, different states.
That would be a curious question.
Yeah.
All right. You can, I think you can do an as-built, or you become a manufacturer and make your own VIN if you're become a by the, you apply to the state to become a manufacturer, and then you can make your own VIN number. But most of the builders that I see, especially the smaller ones, they use the utility trailer title, and then they sell the tiny house with it. Transfer of that utility trailer title and a bill of sale for the tiny house is kind of how they do that. Well, let's move on to the weight distribution. This photograph that you see right here has the wheels basically in the center of this build.
I was watching that.
Talk about the 60-40 weight distribution.
Right, and that's one of the problems with using a trailer that's not designed for a tiny house, and also a trailer that has been used for an equipment hauler, because they don't always follow that 60-40 rule. They normally put the tires to the center of the trailer, because that's where, when you load the equipment on there, that's where you're going to have most of your weight. The other problem you run into with that too is that the leaf springs, a lot of them don't even have the leaf springs. So you've got a house that, if it goes down the road, it's just going to bounce and bang and knock everything loose in it. But the 60-40, when you were talking about earlier about people using a travel trailer, trailer itself to convert it, those have already been engineered for that particular travel trailer that was on that at one time. And generally they follow the 60-40 rule, because if you have too much weight in the back, she's gonna, or in the front, she's gonna fishtail on you. So weight is really important with all these.
Yeah, well, it's on the back where there's too much weight. So what we're talking about here is 60% of the weight being on the tongue, and 40, you know, where that center line is. If it's a dual axle, it's right in the center of those dual axles, and you want 60% of your weight on the tongue and 40% of weight toward the back from that center point. And this tiny house may be a 60-40 if they have the kitchens and the baths on the Tongue side, and it looks like they have a some kind of a loft built up there, so that's extra weight too. So they may be okay with this one, but when you're building your tiny house and locating your axle assembly, a single axle is going to tend to sway more than a dual axle or a triple axle. But all of them, if you just use that 60-40 rule and put your weight distribution 60% toward the tongue and 40% toward the back. All right, well, let's move on to the next one. And I think, next one we're going to talk about stairs and lofts. Anybody want to jump on this rise and run formula? I know it's been a confusing issue down the way. Nobody wants to, I'll start it out.
I don't want that one.
Well, according to we're using Appendix Q, and we're also using ANSI 119.5 for this formula. And according to the formula, it says that the run needs to be a minimum of 7 inches and the rise a maximum of 12 inches. So Rich and Andy, you do a lot of inspections on regular homes. How does that differ from a regular stairway?
On my end, being in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania has their own amendments to the IRC. So we're 8 1/4 rise maximum with a 9-inch minimum run.
Okay.
And then that's 7 and 10, I believe.
So yeah, so that makes sense. And then there also is some kind of a number. They can't vary, each rise can't vary, but 1/4 inch or 3/8 inch.
Yeah, 3/8 inch.
Total.
Right.
Okay, so that's something when you're building your tiny houses that we've seen, guys, where one riser is going to be 8 inches and the next riser is 9 inches, and then because they're building boxes, right, and using them for storage. But that's something to pay attention to, no more than 3/8 inch in your change in your rises as you go up there. Deviation, I guess, is a better word. And then the formula is kind of crazy. So let's just say your minimum tread depth is going to be 20 inches minus 4/3 the riser height. So if we say we want to go the maximum riser height of 12 inches, then we're going to take 4/3 of that. So it's going to be 12 divided by 3, right? 12 divided by 3. 4 times 12 divided by 3 is what? 4 times 12.
So you would minus 16 from the 20.
So you're going to have a minimum tread depth
of 6.
Of 6 from 20 is going to be 4. So, but you can't have any less of a run than 7. So that you can do a 7-inch run and a 12-inch rise. But according to this formula, you could get to a 4-inch run, but you can't, you don't want to do that. You still have to meet the minimums. And so when you use this formula, just make sure that if you come up with a less than 7-inch for a run or let, then you've got to meet at least the minimum run. So on this situation, if you're going to use a 12-inch rise, then you have to have a 7-inch run, even though the formula will let you have a 4-inch run. And it makes common sense. If you're going to, you're going up steps, you don't want to be stepping on a 4-inch run, meaning the tread, the horizontal portion. All right, what about guardrails and handrails?
Well, the guardrails, any loft that is either sleeping or living must have a guardrail on it.
If it's 30 inches above the floor.
Yes, if the loft is 30, well, yeah.
Which obviously they are.
Right, right.
And what about handrails and guardrails on your stair? Well, tell me about while we're at the loft, on the open side of the loft, how do you put your guardrail up there? What's it going to look like?
Well, the guardrail, you know, as the coach says, that the guardrail has to be at least 36 inches high or 50% of the height of the, from the floor of the loft to the ceiling, whichever is less. And then it's, the guardrail can be anything solid across there. Some of the builders use small storage area going across, or it can be a regular railing, but the what they call pickets or so on the railing greater than 4 inches.
So it has to be, if you have a 4-inch ball, 4-inch diameter ball, you can't push it through anywhere in that guardrail where it would go all the way through.
Right.
Okay. All right. So that makes sense. So in other words, if your loft height is, let's say it goes from 42 down to, you know, a foot, then at the foot area, you have to have a 6-inch height. And at the 42-inch, you have to have a 21-inch height of your guardrail. Is that what we're saying?
That's probably how it would work out, yeah.
But they probably don't do it like that. They probably go 21 inches all the way or something
right.
like that, right. just for aesthetics. But that's the minimums there. And I heard the number that it had to support 200 pounds of pressure. I don't know whether you guys can corroborate that, but that's out of IRC, I believe, is where that number comes from.
Correct.
And then also at the top of the landing, before you're going to crawl into the loft, there are some additional requirements there. So as you're going up your steps or you're going up whatever ladder you have there, the top rung or the top of the landing, there's some other requirements there you want to look at. Double the tread, and in other words, if you have 7 inches for your run, it has to be 14 inches there, and you have to have a certain ceiling height, and I don't remember what that is. It's in the standard. We can look it up, but that's something to take a look at when you're building your tiny house. And are ship's ladders and alternating treads okay, guys?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Well, just so you know, those are options. If you want to, instead of a set of stairs, if you want to use a ladder, they are okay. And alternating treads, even though they're hard to maneuver, they are legal and authorized in there. But just from this slide, just make sure, and we see this a lot, we see the open side of the stairs without a handrail, without a guardrail, and they'll put a handrail on the wall, but they don't put it on the open side of the loft and the stairs. And that is a requirement that not only for safety, but it is a requirement per the standard in the code. All right. Primary and second, what does it mean by a primary and a secondary egress?
Primary egress is always going to be your main door leaving the house. The secondary means of egress, all residents must have two means of egress. If you have a loft, you'll have to have a secondary means of egress in the sleeping area. And the minimum size is going to be an opening of 17 by 24. And you can use skylight as long as the skylight isn't greater than, I think it's 44 inches from the floor.
Right.
And a skylight I've seen, because we're allowed to have an ellipsoid, a 24 inch by 24 inch skylight will fit this 17 by 24 ellipsoid in it. So if you are using a skylight, you can, in order to get that minimum. Now we're talking right now, when we're talking 17 or 24, we're talking about an RV egress. And these are only, right now, we're only required to have egresses out of sleeping areas. So out of your living room, your kitchen, your bathrooms, you don't have to have egresses. This is only in sleeping areas. So is there a difference between the RV egress and the IRC egress?
Yeah, the IRC egress is 20 by 24.
Minimum dimension,
right, minimum.
with a 5.0 or a 5.7 square foot total opening.
So what's the difference between 5.0 and why can you do a 5.0? Where do you do that?
So a 5.0 is if you have a bedroom on the first floor grade level, and then the 5.7 comes into play when you're on the second floor to provide a larger egress for if they ever have to use a ladder to get you out or something like that for the fire department.
So when we're building a tiny house on wheels, we are using the RV egress unless your municipality requires it to be built to IRC. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. And what type of labeling do we put on the secondary egress?
So there has to be a sign on the window itself or on the jams that says exit or egress or exit egress. Yeah, there's one of those two.
And what color?
In red.
And also the handle that opens, the mechanism that opens, one or two handles would have to be in red. I put down here 2-foot rule. Tony, do you know what the 2-foot rule is?
Yeah, if you have a sleeping area on the first floor and the door is within 2 foot of the foot of the bed, then that will count actually as your egress.
Okay, but they still have to have a secondary somewhere. So because there's another part in the code that says have to have a primary and a secondary.
Right.
But if you have a bed or a couch, a pull-out couch, and it's within 2 feet of the primary, then that sleeping area does not have to have a second egress.
Correct.
Correct.
Cool. All right. Very good. And as you guys are...
Where the code gets a little funny on that is that part of the code says, of course, it explains... if you have a sleeping area and egress and so forth, but there's a section of the code that says all dwellings must have 2 means of egress.
Right.
A primary and a secondary.
So right. So
if that bed was within 2 foot of the main door, it counts as that's egress, but you're still going to need a secondary egress somewhere else in the house itself.
Either another door or another window.
Right, correct.
Right, that would meet that. That makes sense. So for instance, if you had a bedroom, a loft, and you had an egress out of there and you had an entry door into your tiny house, but you had a bed downstairs that was within 2 feet of the main primary entry, primary egress, then you wouldn't have to have a secondary means of egress out of that quote unquote bedroom.
Right.
All right. And I was going to say, as you guys, you know, if you have questions about any of this, please start putting those into the chat in the Q&A portion right at the bottom of your screen. You'll see a Q&A. And if you'll go ahead and put that in there, then we can answer your questions at the very end, time permitting. All right. Let's talk electrical. Mm. Everybody want to jump in here on that?
Yeah, you know that center picture you have there is just so cute.
What are we looking at here, Tony?
We're looking at an electric panel that was installed over their toilet. And the code is real specific about electric panel placement. And there's 3 primary places in your tiny house that you can't put it. One is, of course, in a bathroom or a wet area. On the stairs going up, like if you're going up your steps and on the sidewalk, you can't have it there. And then in a closet, especially a closet being where you're going to hang clothes or use for storage, are not allowed to be in any of those 3 locations. Now, they can be outside, as long as the panel itself is rated for outdoor use.
Okay. All right. And how about they have to have a certain amount of clearance so you can walk up to the panel and turn the breakers?
Yeah, and in the tiny houses, that's really tough. But the code does require like the center line of the panel to the left 24 inches and to the right 24 inches. And then in front of the panel, is 36 inches. Sometimes where some of them are placed are a little tough to get that, but that's what we try to achieve with that much clearance.
And how about the height of it?
Well, the height is, the rule of height on that is the highest circuit breaker in the panel, the handle of the circuit breaker can't be higher than 6'7".
Okay.
So you have to keep it doesn't really give you a minimum height. So, you know, you can be placed low. Actually, if you go into an RV, you'll see a lot of the RV panels are like right an inch or so above the floor.
Okay.
The other thing that electric panel has to be done is it must be bonded to the trailer frame. And you do that by means of number 8 copper wire on the ground bus bar going directly down to the trailer frame.
Okay. And what about a separate bus bar in the panel for a ground and a neutral?
Yeah, a lot of the panels nowadays are coming through without that separate ground bar. So if your panel doesn't have that separate ground bar, you have to purchase it separately. Usually they got them in a little bag hanging next to where they sell the panels. I don't know why they stopped including it with some of the panels, but it must have that second or to have that ground bus bar. The electric panel in a tiny house is considered a sub panel. So a sub panel must be grounded to the trailer frame.
And how about all the metal on the trailer, the siding and the roofing, et cetera?
Well, the roof itself also must be grounded to the trailer frame. And if you have siding, a metal siding on there, that should be grounded to the trailer frame too. The other ground that people forget about too is if you have propane in the home, the propane line must be grounded to the trailer frame.
All right. One item I want to just clarify really quick is, and I don't, maybe I misheard it, but the clearances, the side clearances on the from the panel, I thought there was a 24 inch. I thought I heard 24 inches. It's 15 inches on each side, so 30 inches total side to side.
Is that what it is? I thought it was 24. It might be 15.
Yeah,
we'll have to look that up for you guys, but That is something we'll check out. How about GFIC or arc faults? Are they required in a tiny house?
I can't find anywhere in the code where it says that the arc fault is required. Now, some of the builders have asked about it, and I've said I would recommend it for at least a circuit that is for your bedroom. But in the RV, because the codes really are reflective of an RV, and I cannot find it. Of course, GFCIs are required, but I...
Where are they required?
Now, the GFCI is required on any outdoor outlet, in bathroom, and your kitchen circuits. And one thing that I find that some builders have been forgetting or missing is your bathroom is required to have a 20 amp circuit to the outlet where the sink is, if you're having a sink in that bathroom.
So if you have a sink, you have to have a 20 amp circuit
outlet. Yes, it must be 20 amp, right?
What if you just have a toilet and a shower in the bathroom?
I don't think you need to have an outlet in there.
Okay. All right. How about, I wrote down here, 220 amp circuits to the kitchen. Can you?
Yeah, that's correct. Each kitchen is required to have 220 amp circuits. They're referred to as small appliance circuits. Now, a lot of builders will run a 20 amp circuit for a separate circuit for their refrigerator, and then one for the outlet on over the counter. And that is to appliance circuits, so that will work, but they are required to have 220 amps.
Okay.
Robin?
Yeah.
Hate to interrupt, but we have a question. Do y'all want to handle those now or at the end of your?
Go ahead and we'll jump in with that. Okay. It looks like we're going to be tight on time. So let's go ahead and catch this question real fast.
20
okay. inches. Oh, I'm sorry. You can see it?
Like, if that's the minimum width of stairs, yes, 20 inches.
Yes, sir. Okay, perfect. 20 inches. Thank you, guys.
All right. Let me X out of that one. And go on to the next. Smoke detectors and CO detectors. I think, Rich, you had mentioned something about that.
You know, can we go back for a quick second to where we are talking about the electric panel and grounding and so forth, and the grounding of the roof and all. A lot of times what we're finding is they're bringing the ground from the roof down and into the panel and into the ground bus bar. And then from the ground bus bar, they're going down to the trailer frame. And that's not the proper way to do it. The roof grounding must go directly down to the trailer frame. And same thing with the electric panel, that has to go directly to the trailer frame. One can't stop off at another place first.
All right. So the ground, the electric panel to the frame, and then everything else that's metal, siding, roofing, piping, whatever, gets grounded to the trailer frame.
Right.
With a proper connection to the trailer frame.
Right. So each item would go down separately and connect.
Right.
Is right. Yeah, you can't jump from one area to the next.
And when we say a proper connection, are we talking about a screw with a wire wrapped around it, or what are we talking about there?
Well, most of them are using what's called a lug, but
a grounding lug.
Some of them with where it's been a screw and a washer. As long as they've cleaned the frame off really good around where they're going to where it's going to connect, and make sure that it's a good solid connection.
Okay. All right, moving right along.
Okay, so smoke detectors. So we recently changed over from just requiring a smoke detector to requiring it to be hardwired. It's a safer route to have it hardwired. It doesn't cost anything additional because they come in both fashions, and it's as simple as running a piece of 14-2 up from say an electrical circuit on an outlet. As far as a CO detector, so one thing you have to watch out for is the difference between a carbon monoxide detector and a propane detector, because most tiny houses have propane. So you would want an LP detector for that, not so much as a carbon monoxide, unless you have access to natural gas where the home would be going on, say somebody's private lot, as opposed to a trailer park or something like that, or an RV park.
Okay, and where do you put these detectors? High, low, middle?
The smoke detectors are supposed to be up high. Each smoke detector you buy will come with manufacturer's recommendations of insulation, but it's typically on within 6 to 12 inches of the highest point on the ceiling.
How about the LP?
The LP, they actually, most of the units are plug-ins, and it's heavier gas as opposed to a smoke, so they'd want that down closer to floor level.
Okay, all right, because gas is heavier and it's going to be down low, and that's where they're going to detect it. The other ones go up high, smoke and CO.
Thank you for tuning in to our first podcast. This was the first half of a two-part podcast, and next month we will finish. Our schedule will be the first Monday of every month. Remember to like us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And for a copy of the show notes and transcript, email Leanne at noahcertified.org.